All right, good afternoon. Good afternoon. We'll go ahead and get started. We do have a forum, so we will get going here. We have quite a few items to cover. So we'll continue with the comprehensive plan update. Ryder? Mitzi? Whoever.
So Charlie's just going to refresh some of the slides that we ended with last week, and then he's going to dive in a little deeper on the land use and transportation pieces. And we should have some time when we're done.
So I'm glad to be here after last week's debacle. Trying to get here.
So that picture, that video of you getting pulled off the plane was terrible.
Yeah, it felt like it. I was supposed to be here at 9 in the morning, and I got here at 9 at night.
So. Okay.
Head of 9?
Head of 9? Head of 9, head of 2. Anyway, so as Mitzi said, we wanted to just real quickly kind of touch on a little bit of what she talked about last week, just to kind of set the stage for the new information we'll see. So, focusing kind of on the land use, and really think about this presentation as going to be kind of two pieces, one that's more about the land use framework and one that's more about the transportation framework. So starting out on the transportation side, in the plan we've included what we call the development vision. So this is intended to provide kind of a high-level picture of how we see the city developing in the future, to kind of provide an overall framework for the more detailed, both detailed policy as well as then the subsequent work on ordinance language changes and so on. But this provides kind of the overall kind of 5,000, 10,000 foot view, whatever you want to call it. Basically, in terms of the development vision, we have four kinds of areas. And by using reference to these areas, what we're trying to do is kind of create an image of the different place types that one will see in the city. Obviously, some of these areas are already developed, but there'll certainly be a fair share of areas that we expect to see change. So we have neighborhoods, we have centers, which can be both transit-oriented centers as well as more auto-oriented types of centers, corridors and districts. Mitzi, I think, introduced you to the idea of the primary transit network last week, which is highlighted here in blue, so that's a type of corridor. And then with that, that sort of frames the differentiation to some extent of the center, so that along the PTN we have what we call transit-oriented corridors, such as the IBM area, the intersection of Broadway and 37th Street, and so on. And then we have more auto-oriented centers, such as Apache Mall, Northwest Plaza, and so on. There's kind of major auto-oriented centers and secondary centers as well. So again, as I say, this is just kind of create an image in people's minds about what the future shape of the city will be. I'll skip over some of that and move then into a new area of discussion here, which Mitzi didn't get into. So one of the things we're proposing in this plan is to include what we call a map that identifies areas of stability and change. And this will sort of lay on top of the future land use map. And probably the easiest way to describe this is to use an example. And unfortunately, again, that slide's not coming up. But I'm going to take low-density residential as my example here. On the future land use map, we have a lot of areas that are shown as low-density residential. They can be located out on the edge of the city in areas that aren't yet developed, where we expect to see new growth. They can be in areas such as Elton Hills, where you have a very stable neighborhood without seeing any decline or any kind of need for revitalization, or they could be neighborhoods like Northrop, adjacent to downtown, where we see aging of the housing stock, we've seen some decline, we would like to encourage sort of a pattern of revitalization. So that's the purpose of this map, is to provide distinction between those different kinds of low-density areas. On the future land use map, they all show up as just low-density residential, but we don't think that, you know, we want to treat all those areas the same. Mm-hmm. On the edge of the city, we want to provide more flexibility, allow developers a little more latitude in terms of what they're doing. In an area like Elton Hills, we really don't want to see much change, so it's going to be fairly stable, fairly restrictive in terms of what can be done in terms of infill or redevelopment in an area like that. And then an area like Northrop, you know, again, where we want to try and introduce some revitalization, not necessarily the wide latitude that you might have on the edge of the city, but allowing some ability to do, to introduce maybe different kinds of housing style that may increase the density a little bit, doing some things with public investment in terms of the street right-of-ways or maybe enhancing park facilities, but those kinds of things that can help sort of bring those areas back to what they used to be. So that's the main purpose of introducing the idea of a stability and change map, is to allow us to make some clarification in the basic underlying land use density and then shape policies and ultimately shape zoning regulations or other programs to help accomplish that. So with that, we'll move on into the land use plan. So the land use plan, again, is not a zoning map, as we explained last week. It's really a guidance tool to provide direction to the community, both to the development industry, to neighborhoods, on what the expectations are for lands in given areas. It guides both the creation of zoning regulations and also guides investment decisions that the city and private sector make. It also works to, you know, the other agencies beyond the land use agency, parks, sewers, electrical department, all those agencies also plan around the future land use map. So this is just a quick matrix here of the categories that will be on, that we're proposing as part of the proposed future land use map. So some of these do not change from the current map, but we are introducing some that are new. The five main categories are residential, mixed use grouping, which is largely new, non-residential, which is fairly similar to what we've had, a broader range of what we call community anchors, where we identify really specific sites, specific development types around the community that really are major nodes of activity, and they include policies then around those specific types of activity centers. And then the preservation areas, which includes things like park and open space and the urban reserve out on the edge of the city where future growth will happen. So with this particular slide, I've tried to dig into that a little bit deeper to highlight what's staying the same and what's changing. So starting on the left here, in terms of the residential categories, currently we have a pretty basic group of residential categories, low density, medium density, high density. We retain those in the proposed plan, but we add two new categories, one for traditional neighborhoods, which is the area, basically the neighborhoods around the downtown, where we want to introduce some policies that would allow for some different kinds of treatments in terms of infill and redevelopment and revitalization than we see in a traditional low or medium density area. And then we're also introducing what we call a neighborhood destination category. So what that category will do will allow for the identification and a set of policies for the development of small commercial areas or the introduction maybe of some different little higher density housing styles or the introduction of other community facilities like schools and so on, where we want to sort of derive and drive some certain kinds of design and urban form kind of characteristics, which we don't have guidance for in our current plan or in our current zoning by setting this up as we have proposed here, that sets the stage for being able to establish policies and regulations around those kinds of uses, and hopefully possibly get us away where we are having maybe so many restricted use developments and those kinds of things by setting a framework that allows us to handle it more in a normal course of action under the land development manual eventually. The mixed-use grouping, currently really the only mixed, what I would consider a mixed-use category of land use that we have is the Central Business District. What we're doing with that district is actually breaking it into two, a downtown core and a downtown fringe, and I'll talk about that in a few slides here so you can see the distinction there. And then the introduction of mixed-use transit-oriented categories, so this really ties the land use piece of it into the transit piece and the primary transit network, where we set up a set of categories that really talk about the pattern of land use that we want to see or hope to encourage along the primary transit network. So there's two categories, the mixed-use centers and the mixed-use corridors, which apply to the bulk of the PTN network. We do have certain corridors like 4th Street Southeast, where we see that as really being more residentially oriented than a corridor like North Broadway. So we set out a separate land use category for what we're calling transit supportive neighborhood corridors, and that would apply like on 4th Street. We also think that there's some other corridors not on the PTN where we have multiple bus routes on those corridors, corridor like 7th Street, for example, where you have a fairly good level of transit service, so that we think those corridors could support potentially more, a greater mix of uses, maybe a little higher density, even though they aren't on PTN. So that's where this transit supportive neighborhood category would apply. In terms of the non-residential categories, really just some subtle changes here, but nothing significant. The commercial category and the light industrial business park that we have in the current plan are really being combined into what we call a commercial and business development category. We retain an industrial category for those kinds of uses that have externalities like a lot of truck traffic or noise or a lot of lighting that potentially could be spilling out into other areas. So have a designation for those kinds of uses that separate from the other commercial uses. And then have added what we call a small employment development classification. And this is intended for areas like 6th Avenue Northwest, like between 7th Center Drive and 7th Street, where you have uses where there are maybe startup businesses, they're looking for small spaces. We want to accommodate, maybe they don't really have so much, maybe they're more neighborhood oriented or they don't really need as much parking as other kinds of commercial uses, more standard kind of commercial uses might need. So we provided for a category like that in the plan. And then as I say, we have a group of anchors as well. Currently we have a medical classification in the plan, we retain that, and then add categories for educational campuses. So this is at the high school and above, post-secondary level, identifying those as sort of separate under a separate classification. Civic facilities, get into areas like the Civic Center, like 125 Live, where you have a lot of activity occurring, you're drawing a lot of people into sites, and formulating and having some policy around that in terms of location, function for those kinds of uses that would be different than you would find under just a standard commercial or a standard CBD category, for example. And then obviously the airport is kind of its own use.
So Charlie, can I ask a question on that slide?
Yeah.
Obviously you're introducing more granularity to the land use. And I know this might be premature, but are you anticipating we'll see more granularity in the zoning?
Yes, we will.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Yep. So the because I kind of want to focus on the new categories that would be the big change from, you know, kind of the current framework for land use regulation. So talk a little bit here about transit-oriented development. Kind of the key features of TOD is, you know, what we're trying to think about here is a way to build a neighborhood, a way to build a corridor that's oriented around transit use, and to get people, to provide people opportunities and choice to locate in locations where they have better transit service. So the kinds of land use considerations that become important in those areas are walkability, pedestrian design, the mix of uses that happens in those areas. What you want to try and do is create areas that are not just simply origins, but you want to get a mix of origins and destinations, preferably in those areas, to help facilitate some level of walking trips, as well as the use of transit. And obviously, there's still going to be some level of vehicular traffic that is generated and goes to those areas. And then the density itself, Mitzi talked last week, I believe, a little bit. She touched on the idea that we need to get to a certain level of density along these transit-oriented corridors in order to make the primary transit network function appropriately. If we want to try and increase the frequency of service, we need to get to a level of at least 25 persons per acre, so a combined level of residents and employees that are in those corridors and in those nodes reaches at a minimum 25 persons per acre. So that's going to mean a little bit different, you know, a little higher density type of housing, although it doesn't mean high rise by any means, but it does mean a little higher densities on the residential side. And, you know, I think the commercial uses might not be much different than what you normally see in other commercial corridors. It's just that they're probably going to be a little denser, a little more densely packed than you would see, because with the transit orientation, you know, you can probably reduce the parking to some extent and open up some more land for development through that. So, when we talk about these kinds of corridors, there's a lot of considerations that come into play, and there's a whole set of policies that we don't have time to go through today that discuss things like transition to adjacent neighborhood areas, what do we mean and what does it look like when we talk about walkability and the street grid and the public realm, what's the range of uses that are desirable in those areas. So all those kinds of issues are discussed in the plan itself. You know, there's an illustration here. I mean, these are kind of at the extremes to some level, but the top graphic here being, you know, a very auto-oriented kind of environment and how that changes when you get into a more of a transit-oriented and pedestrian-oriented environment, affecting things like building setback, the amount of land that's devoted to parking, the landscaping, the streetscape. All those factors come into play. In terms of kind of the pattern of development that we see along these trends, that we expect to eventually develop along these transit-oriented corridors, is sort of a pulsed pattern of development where you have centers of higher intensity development. So for example, on North Broadway, we've defined the node around 7th Street and Broadway, the node around like 14th Street and Elk Hills Drive, and then up at 37th Street, there's nodes of higher intensity development. And then in between those nodes, you step down to a lower intensity of development, and then from the corridor, as you back off into the neighborhoods, you step back down into more of a neighborhood type of density. So this is the kind of pattern, looking a little more specifically at what a transit node location like 7th Street and Broadway might look like. You have a situation there where you would see higher intensity development on the Broadway frontage, but also stepping back along 7th Street for a block or two. And then, so that's kind of your core of the node. And then as you back away from that core in all directions, you step down to a little lower level of intensity until you get back to the neighborhood. So it's probably a one to up to maybe a three block area that becomes sort of the definition of the node, and in which you see this higher intensity at the center of the node and then backing down into the neighborhood. So there's policy around, you know, again, urban form, urban design, streetscape, you know, parking needs. One of the things with these type of nodal developments is to provide some opportunity to approach parking from the perspective of not each use having to have its own parking, but providing sort of a node or district kind of parking approach in these nodes. So just some of the factors to keep in mind there when we talk about this transit-oriented pattern of development. So this shows kind of these higher, so there were a set of higher intensity nodes and then some of the lower intensity nodes. So this would be typical of like a North Broadway, South Broadway. Just by contrast, like along a 4th Street Southeast, we would not expect to see the same level of intensity at the node. So like at 11th Avenue and 4th Street Southeast, there would be some intensification that could be expected there, but not to the same scale like on a North Broadway. And again, backing off into the neighborhood and then policies around the shape that that development should take. I think those of you, anyone who's traveled to other cities and that maybe utilized transit, streetcar, light rail, whatever, like up in the Twin Cities, you know, the pattern of development along PTN network, you know, we expect will, at least the hope is, will sort of evolve to those kinds of patterns. You know, where attached housing, you have the 1 to 2, maybe 3 story where you have business on the ground floor, housing above it, those kinds of styles of development emerging along the PTN, along the major PTN corridors. So any question before I move on here, any questions about kind of transit-oriented growth and the expectation?
Just a comment. I know earlier in your, one of your earlier slides talked about stability and change and identifying those areas.
Right.
And I think that that's going to be a key part of the overall strategy. Much of what I'm seeing so far would be absolutely phenomenal if we were starting with a blank sheet of paper, but we're not.
Right.
And how we transition and how we identify those areas that are more amenable to change versus those that are going to be more stable, I guess,
right,
will be important.
Yeah. One of the things I'll talk about here in a little bit is infill and redevelopment and how that happens and the need that we see for kind of infill and redevelopment policy that really kind of gets at what you're talking about. So, so the next area I want to talk a little bit about is the downtown. So as I said, currently we just have one classification of a general central business district. We're proposing that that gets split up into a central core category and a downtown fringe category. And really the intent there is to put together some policy and put some definition in place that helps describe the fact that we want to get the most intense development happening in a core area of downtown. And this really is building on policy that was established in the downtown master plan, which is where this lower graphic comes from. But the idea that the highest intensity of use happens in a core area, and then you back away from that core area as you move out towards the fringe of the downtown area and towards the adjacent neighborhoods. So, you know, the kind of development you would expect to see with those kinds of policies is a central core where you have the tallest, most intense buildings, and then backing away from that as you move away from that core, as you get to the edge of the central development area, you know, you still have a mix of uses in terms of business employment, some residential, multifamily residential, but now you're transitioning down to where your height limits, your setbacks, sort of the design of the buildings becomes a lot more compatible within what we start to see in the residential areas and the multifamily development that, that tends to happen in those areas. So we thought it was important to sort of make this distinction rather than trying to describe all of that under the rubric of one single downtown category. traditional downtown neighborhoods. So what we've done in the draft plan at this point is identify set of areas around the downtown, the Northrop area, the eastern half of Kutztie, the east side, and then the Slattery area, where we expect that, again, there'll be policies in the plan that talk about kind of the revitalization of those areas and what that means. We want to encourage, I think last week Mitzi talked about housing types and this nomenclature, this idea of missing middle housing, where you try and introduce the ability to do some of the maybe older styles of housing and bring those back where you have a little greater density, but really the character of the structures fit very well with the older single family housing. So you can kind of intensify the area a little bit, and given that it's in close proximity to downtown, you're not really necessarily generating the same level of vehicle traffic that you would see in a neighborhood out on the edge of the city because of the walkability to the, you know, and the distance, the walking distance to downtown. So it's a different kind of context, different kind of character that we're trying to encourage with the policy and the mapping of these areas. So again, this.
I was going to say, one thing we talked about last week on that map or with that concept is that with zoning, we will need to more finely delineate areas where a transformational redevelopment might be acceptable. In other areas where if there is infill and redevelopment, maintaining a character of the neighborhood is more important. So the form and the style of the buildings would have to be addressed differently.
And actually, one of the things that we've done in the narrative is Slattery is probably a good example here is to have some discussion about the fact that, you know, there's sort of a walking distance to the center of downtown where it's more likely that people who work in the central core will walk. And those areas, so like the northern half of the Slattery area, is an area where maybe a little higher density is accommodated. But as you get more to the southern stretches of this area where you're probably getting out beyond maybe a walkable distance, that you really step that back into more of a lower density, very similar density-wise in terms of the housing that's there. So there's kind of a gradient happening within an area like that as well. One of the things with this idea of missing middle housing and all these different styles is we've looked at what other cities have done, and this really kind of gets us beyond the land use plan, gets a little bit of your comment, Randy. But what we've seen is that cities that have taken this approach have really, when they've gotten to the zoning level of things, have started to look at not just structuring their zoning regulations on the basic of lot size and setback that apply to whatever you're doing, but really try and sort of target and shape the zoning regulations more to the different styles of housing so that something like a cottage home would be allowable on a smaller lot than a standard R1 lot, and that there'd be some expectations about setbacks and stuff so that you really get to a more detailed level of zoning regulation in areas like that. So with the idea that the overall, it kind of keeps the overall level of density, you know, it allows it to rise up a little bit, but still the structure and the density and the shape and architecture of the structures is still fairly compatible. And the spacing between buildings and the visual image doesn't change that much from the traditional housing that was in the neighborhood.
Ideally, the kind of flexibility and density you're talking about would have a positive impact on affordability also.
Right. You know, to the extent that you know, some of these housing styles allow for smaller unit sizes, smaller lot sizes, so, right.
The other thing is some of this is our most affordable housing stock for single family and first-time home buyers. And so programs that help to restore or reinvest in those properties, upgrade them, put new roofs on them, change out windows, those kind of things help to reinvest in the neighborhoods and to stabilize them too and maintain that for more affordable audience.
So as I mentioned before, one of the things that we have a discussion in the draft plan about is infill and redevelopment and the importance of how we handle infill and redevelopment, because we're going to have a number of areas, these transit-oriented growth corridors along the TTN, the traditional downtown neighborhoods, where infill and redevelopment is going to take on added importance. So one of the, you know, what that language talks about is how to approach infill and redevelopment. Obviously, there's different kinds of things you want to try and encourage. In some cases, it's the removal of blighted structures. In other cases, it may be the renovation of existing structures. Just some examples. Actually, in the plan, we kind of talk about these separately, but there's the transformation of commercial corridors like North Broadway to a PTN corridor. So there's language that talks about things like how do we improve pedestrian safety and comfort, you know, access to transit, where that happens, how that's structured, what the streetscape, the public realm of the street corridors looks like, and to some extent the design of the buildings in terms of, you know, do you have glass, do you have windows, do you sort of open up the buildings to the street, when is that needed or desired, you know, when might you not do that, where does parking get located in situations like this, or a whole set of kind of policies that are wrapped around this idea of a more transit-oriented style of development. Another kind of set of narratives is around the idea of grayfield redevelopment. So grayfield refers to the idea of, you know, either dying big boxes or old shopping center style of development that's really underutilized, and how you go about potentially maybe even infilling that development and tying it back into the street grid and the neighborhood grid by going from a situation where it's not just reuse of the existing building, but it's actually introducing streets and smaller sites within, you know, what used to be this large auto-oriented footprint. So there's a discussion of grayfield redevelopment in the plan. And then in terms of traditional neighborhood and redevelopment and infill in those areas, in addition to kind of the density and the lot sizes and those kinds of things that are tied more to the building types, even getting into some of the architecture where you start to, you know, what we've seen in other cities where they try and identify kind of what are the key features, architectural features of structures in these existing neighborhoods, and then, you know, the new things that are being introduced need to, at some level, you know, kind of match that style to some extent. So you see, you know, for example, down here where you have dormers and roof pitch and things like that, that even on a new development can match what the older structures were doing, so that when the, those are being designed, they're being designed with the understanding to kind of fit in better with the older homes that are in neighborhoods. So kind of to summarize, infill and redevelopment, you know, kind of the goals here are to promote reinvestment in areas with underutilized or underperforming land, concentrate higher density and mixed-use housing in certain locations where we can serve those areas with higher frequency transit in the future, try and get a wider range, wider mix of housing styles. One of the things, again, that Mitzi had talked about and that we heard in our early public input was the desire for people to see more options in terms of housing choice. So, you know, if we think in these areas in particular, are prime areas where, you know, introducing different kinds of housing, different styles of housing would be compatible, and again, promoting the revitalization of these areas. So that finishes up the land use piece of this. I want to move in now to transportation. And as Mitzi emphasized last week, and we talked about, you know, there's a lot of integration between land use and transportation. The framework for transportation really revolves around three major areas. There's sort of system aspects street network, transit network, pedestrian network, and so on. So the plan talks about each of those networks. There's a service component, so we talk about things like transit service, commuter services, shared mobility, and policies and discussion in the plan around those things. And then there's kind of the whole downtown DMC issue that we have tried to integrate into the plan at a fairly high level at this point, since we don't know the outcome of the studies that are ongoing right now. But, you know, we have the circulator, how the street right-of-way is utilized, city route concept, parking management, and so on. So policies around, there's some very high-level policy discussion around those things. So transportation is really, unlike the land use so much, transportation is really kind of a means to an end. It's really the activity that's happening at the land use that we're interested in, whether that's jobs, whether that's people's homes, healthy neighborhoods, parks, those kinds of things. So transportation supports a lot of that, whether it's economic growth, placemaking, housing affordability, the kinds of things we want to consider, that we try and consider as part of structuring the transportation system and services, is questions of accessibility, how can we best integrate the different modes to best serve the range of people in the community, how efficient is transportation in meeting people's needs, and achieving, you know, specifically looking at the transportation networks like the street systems. What's the right balance between preservation and renewal of what we have in place and spending dollars, spending resources on expanding the system? So can we do things that maybe tilts that scale a little bit more towards having more money for preservation and renewal by maybe shaping the land use so we don't have to create so much new infrastructure going forward? I think I'll just jump right into the transit, primary transit network. So again, you had an introduction to this last week, more sort of from the land use perspective. Just a couple slides here to try and highlight what we're on the transportation side, what we're trying to do. So kind of there's four key principles that really play into kind of creating these high level premium transit networks, where you can actually support like a 10 or 15 minute service headway. Density, as we talked about, is important. Walkability is important. Continuity, and what that means is really setting up your network such that you're really connecting the major activity centers as much as possible in the city. So obviously the network focuses on downtown, but downtown is really only one end. Those trips generally are going somewhere or starting somewhere and coming to downtown, so that's why we have these other nodes identified where we're trying to encourage development of other high activity centers, so that we have both origins and destinations that aren't just focused, or trips that aren't just focused with one end on downtown, but actually having other intensity centers of employment that can also be served by the PTN over the long term. And then linearity really gets at the idea of people's kind of the legibility of the system and making a system, creating a system that's easily understandable. So, you know, we want to try as much as possible create corridors that really create sort of a straight travel route. I mean, we have the ability to do that here with Broadway running the length of the city, north and south, and 2nd Street and 4th Street, even though it gets a little offset, that happens downtown. Have a nice east-west and north-south access around which to structure the PTN, and being that those corridors actually have some of the higher intensity development, it fits well with these other principles of transit development. I think the thing to emphasize here on this slide is that if we get the land use in order, we achieve the kinds of densities that we need, and we have these destinations, that will foster a service where we think it will be possible to get to like a 15-minute frequency on the PTN corridors. The good thing, and when you get to 15 minutes or below, is that that's the point where people really start not worrying about the schedule, because they know even if they happen to have missed a connection, it's not very long before the next bus comes along. So that's really sort of a critical long-term goal here, is to get enough drive, enough trip making in those corridors that we can support 15-minute service, so that you really get to the point where it's just almost secondhand, just like using the car is today for a lot of people. Using transit would be very easy.
Let me ask on the primary transit, that loop that goes out to the northwest eventually. Do you see that as being a bi-directional 15-minute service or a single-directional 15-minute service?
Can you say northwest, be more specific?
Well, this is the 2nd Street Circle Drive, 37th, 41st.
It's... there'll be more than likely sort of a loop system. Would it be bi-directional?
Single-directional or both ways?
Both ways.
Okay.
Yes.
That's Circle Drive segments are not anticipated to have the level of service on them. Mm-hmm.
Those are expected to be much longer term, potentially beyond the horizon, the 2040 horizon. So initially, like on Broadway and 2nd Street, I mean, you'll still see bi-directional service, but it won't be mm-hmm. service that's looping all okay. the way around. Yeah. And the other thing is that it's not, the PTN will not, is not a separate, there's vehicles that will probably be branded such that you know mm-hmm. they're part of the PTN, yeah. but they're also supplemented by the regular bus service who is also using those corridors. So between those two, mm-hmm. you know, that's where you're getting down to 10 to 15 minutes. So, one of the things we want to emphasize in terms of the development of this system is that with the ultimate plan here of being that the ultimate service is with bus rapid transit and not with light rail or streetcar or something like that, it gives us the ability to sort of incrementally phase in to that ultimate service by using the current city bus service, increasing frequencies as density, as trip making increases until you reach a certain level where, okay, now we've reached this point of density and trip making that we can support the frequency that's needed to run bus rapid transit. So it's an incremental implementation over time. When I use the term bus rapid transit and how that differs from kind of traditional city bus service, what we see is amenities like stations where you might have people are paying their fares before they get on the vehicle, so that when the BRT vehicle comes up, people are just loading and it's a very short stopover. You have different levels of amenities in terms of the transit stations. Probably think kiosk, you know, bike racks. You might actually have sort of a little bit of a hub there so that people from the adjacent areas, neighborhood areas, who might want to walk or bike, you know, they could actually, there might actually be bike storage and that kind of thing in some of these areas, at some of these stations to facilitate or to try and encourage people to make use of the service. The other thing about BTR, about bus rapid transit, as compared to some of the other rail-based services, is that the operational costs are much lower on a comparable basis. One kind of rule of thumb that I saw is that even with a rail-based service, you probably are likely to attract a little bit more ridership, but with BTR, you can attract probably about 80% of the ridership you could with light rail or a streetcar at about 30% of the cost. So it's much more affordable and cost-effective than looking at a rail-based system, which, you know, going back to like the downtown master plan, that was really kind of the way that was leaning, was, you know, talking about streetcars, talking about kind of rail-based service, and we've kind of moved away from that, in part because of the cost, in part by seeing some of the success that bus rapid transit systems like Cleveland and some other communities have actually had in attracting economic development, as well as being able to provide a good level of ridership and a good service.
So can I infer from that statement then that due to cost, that this was a more Rochester-appropriate option, I would assume that we're also then throwing out elevated and subterranean transit as a result.
Well, that's a different, that's downtown circulator okay. service. So there's still the issue that the downtown studies are looking at about
okay.
parking
so,
from the periphery,
okay.
bringing those people in and how that works. And then there's markets within the downtown like Mayo to St. Mary's. What's the best, you know, how should that be served? So, you know, we're not really talking about the downtown specific services here. I mean, certainly this PTN, BRT is going to go through downtown and serve part of that need. But these other issues about elevated subterranean, those are still on the table in terms of the DMC studies.
Okay.
Mr. Ruska?
I was going down that same road because that's what it seemed to me that you've made the decision. Is. So my question to you is, who and when is that decision going to be made? Because I remember Richard was here a while back, and he said, we haven't made the decision yet if we're going to be, you know, ground transit or elevated or whatever. And who's making that decision and when? And are we going to have any input in that, or how is that going to be yeah. determined?
We'll be seeing stuff coming. So those studies are at a point now where there's been a series of alternatives identified in the next 2 months. The alternatives will get narrowed down to just a couple of options, and you'll be part of that process in May, early June. And then once those, the wider range of alternatives have been narrowed down to two or three, then there's a much more detailed level of evaluation, and then early fall, we come back with the results of that, consultants come back with the results of that evaluation to identify a preferred alternative. And again, you're part of that process. So by the end of the year, we should know the preferred alternative for the downtown pieces of the transportation.
Preferred by who? Just the studies?
By the city.
No. Okay. Right.
I mean, actually, decisions made about what's the preferred option. So moving forward, and you know, as steps are taken to actually get into project development, we're moving into project development with an alternative that everybody's bought into.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So, well, one of the things too, following up on the question here is, I mean, how much of this is going to be for us to decide, and how much of this is going to be hard coded as part of the process for getting federal funds? Because I've always kind of read it that you set up your options, you do your options analysis, and there's a pretty stringent set of guidelines that kind of leads you to the path you want to go if you want the funds.
Well, what I'll say about the federal funds, there are certain things that it may be harder to get federal funds for because of the criteria.
Okay.
So things like a downtown circulator may be a little bit more difficult if you're really like trying to serve the Mayo and the St. Mary's market. That may be tough under okay. certain federal programs to get any funding for that. Bigger picture, the more markets you can point to that are being served by a particular type of system, the better chance we have of getting federal funding. So this last slide about PTN just indicates what we think would be kind of a phasing program of getting to bus rapid transit service. So that the green lines indicate the ultimate BRT type of service. So Second Street Corridor, you know, the density of development is already sort of at that point where you could probably make a case for supporting BRT. Longer term, you know, somewhere in a 10 to 15 year time frame. The 4th Street Corridor, because we have a good node out on the end that generates a lot of transit trips already, probably becomes feasible within that time frame. And then the North Broadway corridor, I think looking at, you know, the uses along that corridor, the idea, at least from our perspective, that that's probably the first corridor where we try and encourage the redevelopment and intensification to occur. But that would be maybe part of that upscaling to a BRT type of service in a 10 to 15 year period. And as I said, through kind of the horizon of the plan through 2040, we probably add a little bit down South Broadway, down maybe to Highway 52, and potentially going out to the IBM Mayo Support Center service. But that would be probably the last phase of this. And that West Circle Drive, 32nd Street, or really out beyond 2040, we think. Just moving to the roadway network real quick here. We don't see a lot of changes really in terms of the policy relative to roadway network development. There's nothing really different being suggested in the plan. Just give you an indication here of tying back to the PTN, what we see some of the effects if we're actually able to create this transit-oriented pattern of growth versus not accomplishing that on the left side. What you see is a map of the major arterial and collector streets with a lot of different colors here, the red in particular being areas to take note of, and the number of those on this map, those are areas where we would expect to see very high levels of congestion develop over time, to the point where even in some of these places like West Circle Drive, 37th Street, if you're not able to reduce the travel demand, those would probably need to be expanded to six-lane corridors if we're still, you know, predominantly vehicle, private vehicle-oriented in terms of travel on those corridors. With the PTN and being able to attract the commuter traffic in particular, since the peak hours mm-hmm. are the key thing, being able to shave some of that peak off of the single occupant vehicle travel, we really reduce the number of these highly congested hot spots down to where really Civic Center Drive.
Mr. Bilderbeck had a question.
Charlie, you talked about congestion. That's different in different places. What's that meaning here when you talk about congestion?
So congestion, as we're talking about it, is really a case where, you know, today you don't really sit through more than a traffic, one cycle of a signal maybe. Okay. When you get to highly congested conditions like at these locations, you're going to be sitting through multiple signals probably in peak hours. So the quality that people are experiencing in terms of the amount of delay is going to go up, travel speeds are going to go down. So it would be a significant difference than what we experienced today.
Thank you.
This is one area that you might remember when we did our scenario plan. We identified potential outcomes for three different patterns of growth. We also identified costs associated with some of these. And clearly on the right side, there's cost avoidance versus trying to add capacity and do mitigation for some of the traffic congestion that would be anticipated.
So just real quickly on streets, obviously we have a variety of users to serve within those right-of-ways, and we expect to continue to do that. The biggest piece of, I guess from my perspective, is really at the design phase in what's called context-sensitive design, you know, taking at the very early stages the different goals that we want to try and accomplish in terms of placemaking and, you know, who we want to serve and what the impact is. We have a complete streets policy, and we've had that since 2009. That'll still be an important part of this. In the plan, we actually have a document, or we have a map that you see here, which tries to establish some priority for complete streets improvements. And this actually, the reason we included this was to try and tie it back to the PTN and the growth of the transit-oriented growth corridors, and saying that, you know, those corridors, if we're going to make some decisions about where to invest money about complete street kind of improvements, that these corridors should be a high priority. So we've included that discussion in the plan. Just real quickly on pedestrian, being sensitive to how much time we have here. Around the issue of pedestrian network development, what we tried to do is again look at where are the high priority areas as we move forward. Again, thinking what we're trying to do in terms of a land use development vision, where do we need to think about investments in pedestrian improvements and walkability. So we've included a map and some narrative that talks about pedestrian districts, largely kind of following or falling around the nodes on the PTN, some pedestrian priority streets, which are largely downtown, recognize the city loop concept downtown, and then this idea that transit connectivity, so along the PTN as we back away and get into the neighborhoods, making sure we're good connectivity in terms of, you know, not having any gaps in the sidewalk network, for example, so that people can take their most efficient route and quickly get to transit stops and transit stations along the PTN. On the bicycle side, same thing that we've done. We tried to identify some focus areas for bicycle improvements, again, tied somewhat to the PTN, but also looking a little bit broader here in terms of other destinations like park and recreation opportunities or open space and recreation opportunities, and identify some corridors that maybe should take a little higher priority over others. We've introduced in the discussion some concepts that are a little bit different than we have in the Bicycle Master Plan, talking about low-stress roadways and protected bicycle facilities, with some illustrations of what those mean, and that you know, in some cases we should be considering some of those kinds of investments as opposed to maybe just a standard on-street bike lane. Skip over here real quick, downtown transportation planning. I think we've talked about the four studies that are ongoing, kind of the moving away from the networks and the physical infrastructure and talking about services. Most of the information in the plan is really narrative and policies built around a lot of different services that we actually have and kind of the changing nature of some of these services. So when I think about mobility services, there's really kind of a range of characteristics that vary, for example, who provides the service, ranging from public to private, and the type of service, ranging from more of a group type of service to more of an individual type of service. So we have local bus service, kind of up on one corner here, Park and Ride Expresses, where we have sort of a group service provided by the public. Dial Ride, which is more individualized, then moving into a series of services, car sharing, bike sharing, van pool, which tend to be kind of a mix. They can be public types of services or they can be private, so it just depends on how they evolve. And then getting into a set of services that really has evolved to be mostly privately provided. So we have things like our regional commuter bus service. We have the TNC transportation network providers like Uber and Lyft that provide individualized service, but also in some cities provide more of a kind of a ride share and Uber pool where they're kind of creating routes on the fly that pick up multiple people, so you have more of a group type of service. So in the plan, as I say, I mean, basically, the policies are supportive of, you know, continuing to advance all these services. Some specific things that as we move ahead through time that would facilitate kind of the evolution and advancement of those. You know, there's some things probably related to requirements in the zoning ordinance that could be thought about, like, for example, requiring car sharing in new residential developments, or providing electrical vehicle charging stations, establishing pickup zones for like an Uber, Lyft type of service, that they actually have designated areas for pickups. I think that will be particularly critical in the downtown area and other higher intensity areas. And then tying some of these things to parking reductions as well. You know, if developers of residential, multifamily residential, are making accommodations for these kinds of benefits and services, that the trade-off being, you know, allowing maybe a little lower level of parking, off-street parking. In terms of incentives, working with individual developers and businesses to provide transit passes, providing individualized services to commuters to help them plan their trips, and you know what kinds of incentives are out there. in terms of service quality, getting to where maybe we have things like a common app in the city of Rochester where somebody can just go into one app and they'll see all their different options that they have available and can actually schedule and request a ride through that universal app. Same thing with payment platforms, evolving to the point of having a common payment platform for the different kinds of services. So a lot of different things here that are still evolving as these, particularly the private services, continue their growth going forward. I think just on the public side, just real quickly here, in terms of transit service, and you've heard some of this as Brian and Tony have talked to you about the transit development plan that, you know, over time, you know, right now we have a very radially oriented kind of service where the downtown is the end of most of the transit routes, and it's very much driven by sort of peak hour demand and getting workers into the downtown, starting to introduce some cross-community routes now in the TDP recommendations. We think that as the PTN emerges, that will probably actually facilitate some more of that, where we see kind of an evolution from a very heavily radially oriented system to more of a grid system, where we're tying the transit route, the standard local bus routes, into the PTN, as opposed to sending all those buses into the downtown core. So we think some more of a gridded network will emerge over time. Park and ride expansion, again, I think Tony and Brian have talked to you about this, but seeing new locations of remote park and ride lots, tying these into the PTN network. And then even thinking about at those locations and potentially even at some of these major TOD nodes, developing what's referred to as mobility hubs, where you have sites that are not simply a parking lot or a parking ramp with a pickup spot, but you start to introduce services to those people who are using the parking lot. So you might have a daycare, or you might have a package like a FedEx stop there, or you might have bike parking. So you get more of sort of a hub that provides services to the primary users, those being the park and ride people, and those being the bus riders, so that they have other things available to them that can hopefully facilitate and kind of provide, be an attraction to getting more people to use the main park and ride service. So there's been some discussion around that already. I think Tony and his folks are looking at maybe a first hub and where would be the best location for that already. But over time, seeing more of those emerge as part of this overall system of commuter services. And finally, travel demand management will be a key piece, particularly as it relates to downtown. And travel demand management refers to putting in place the programs and services to help support people make the choice of not driving their personal vehicle to work. So again, you know, Mayo does a lot of these things already, things like the Transit Pass program that they have, provide guaranteed ride home if somebody has to get back home for an emergency, you know, bike parking, bike lockers, all kinds of things like that. With the work that's being done with the downtown DMC transportation studies, the goal is to try and broaden the base of that beyond Mayo and make it more universal across all the employers that are downtown. So in the comp plan, basically just trying to support that idea of broadening the base of those services to get a little broader utilization, get more people, and help us achieve our goal of trying to reduce that share of single occupant commuting, single vehicle commuting by individuals from 70%, which it's at today, to down to about 50%, which is where we think we need to get to. So with that, I think I'll maybe stop here. This is just more background on that. And if you want to...
Yeah, I can touch on this. So When we look at the overall plan, some of the benefits we think we can get out of this, if we are purposeful in trying to achieve this plan, we can provide more housing and transportation options, which would be responding to the trends and needs of the community, compete better with other economic regions. We know that we'll need to compete for talent and workforce with the projected labor force shortage, and also with the fact that we have other economic centers around the country that provide very competitive services that we need to be competing against. We're competing for customers, clients, patients, and visitors, and also investment in new technology and R&D. We want to reach our full potential as a community and continue to grow the local economy. Places compete to attract and retain talented workers, high-quality jobs, and economic investment. And to attract the workforce, communities do need to be places that respond to changing attitudes and behaviors that are driving people. We need to reduce the growth in vehicular traffic to downtown, and businesses value places that bring together a variety of activities. Ultimately, we will also continue to achieve high ratings in livability. Who can benefit from this? Well, I think there are a broad range of folks that will benefit, including the public. When we have more efficient growth, we can redirect some of our resources toward the maintenance of existing facilities and avoid costs. Also, for residents, it'll be more responsive to the kind of housing and lifestyles that people are looking for, and it'll address the demographic shifts that we anticipate.
And one thing, I'll touch on this, and dollars always get people's attention, so it's been a fair amount of research that we've started to see in the last decade or so around the idea of, is a compact pattern of growth more efficient, and can it reduce the cost of services? Just a couple of studies here, fairly recent, that have been done about the revenue generation possibility of different styles of development. This was a study done in Sarasota, Florida, where they compared kind of more conventional, traditional style of both residential and commercial development against styles of mixed use. And what they found that on a per acre basis, that's what they were looking to compare here, on a per acre basis, when they got to the mixed use styles of developments, which are the green bars at the bottom here, that their revenue per acre, tax revenue per acre, was significantly higher than it was over the conventional styles of development. A similar study done in across three or four different western states, cities in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, came to very similar conclusions. What they saw, again, sort of single-use commercial, the city kind of traditional city residential as compared to mixed use, that the tax revenue on a per acre basis was substantially higher with the mixed use development. The other finding, kind of from a different angle, and that's the cost of providing services. We've seen a number of studies going back quite a period of years, 20 years or more. I just picked two here, one from Madison and one from West Des Moines, where they were trying to compare the cost of providing services, fire, police, transit, and so on, and what happened, comparing a lower density style of development, which would be kind of comparable to our past trends, to a trend that would be more compact, making use of like transit-oriented growth and so on. And what they found was that, getting down to the bottom of the chart here, that with a compact pattern of development, that they were actually able to realize more net revenue, I'll call it, that their costs over the tax revenue they were getting was actually netting out with the mixed-use compact development at a greater level than it was over the traditional style of development. A similar study in West Des Moines found that the walkable urban style of development as compared to low-density, base-density, that the net fiscal impact of the walkable urban was much greater than it was with the traditional style. So there is something, you know, getting back to this idea that, as I mentioned early on, you know, can we shift the pattern such that maybe we can put more of the money, property tax that we're raising towards renewal and preservation, and not necessarily looking so much towards expansion on the edge of the city. And I think some of these numbers help suggest at least trying to encourage that kind of pattern, that more compact pattern will provide a little better net fiscal outcome than a low density style of development. So with that, a number of benefits, I think benefits for developers in terms of maybe somewhat some reductions in development costs. Would hope to see some benefits then translate to the buyers in terms of having more choice. Their combined living costs, the housing and transportation being lower, and some benefits for the public as well in terms of cost savings and more efficient utilization of existing infrastructure. So that's what we had for you.
Questions, comments? Mr. Ruska.
Charlie, thanks for all the good information. Kind of wish we'd had it ahead of time, because I squint to see a lot of those details are difficult to see and to read and to kind of figure. So will this be eventually shared with us or somewhere it's out there we can look at it?
It'll be on the website soon.
Okay.
And I think we can get you, we can certainly send you. Well,
okay.
We'll have a place you can download them.
Yeah, it's a place you can make it print bigger so I can read it. One of the question I had was, we talked about the pedestrian walkability, and one of the things I saw, there's no reference to the current Skyway connections that we have. In fact, your pictures of the downtown didn't reflect any of them on the plans. And as you know, we have a sizable investment in that chain of connections throughout the community. The visitors, locals love them, handicap accessible, safe, climate controlled, visitor friendly. Businesses want to be connected. So is that something that we're going to kind of plan to phase them out, or is this going to be something that we're going to support and utilize as we move forward with them?
Well, I guess from my perspective, downtown, we have a downtown master plan, and we have DMC vision. And really, we're in the comp plan saying that, we've had these two recent plans, that we're really relying on those plans. So to the extent of thinking about things like Skyway that are contained to the downtown, it's really the language in the downtown master plan, because that is part of the comp plan.
Right, okay.
So that drives what's happening in the downtown.
As a planner, you guys see that this is something that we would want to keep healthy and moving forward with? The reason it continues to move out is because the city wants to be connected and more things happen and want to be connected to it. So. Is that a continued growth that you would support and everything that you see?
Well, there's certainly a tension there that, we have given our weather, right?
Right. So, I mean, a lot of good things about it.
There's certainly good things about it. So.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering about is you've got the Skyway level of connectivity and safe pedestrian access, and then you're trying to create another level below that, is it counterproductive to try to do both?
Well, I really don't see the issue of third level, the below level, other than, in terms of the work we're doing with the DMC studies, that is really even only on the table because of the, as an option of connected Mayo to St. Mary's. Nowhere else is there any discussion of subway level type of.
Well, I'm just talking about street level, though. You have street level and then,
Skyway, certainly. There's a balance there between commercial, the commercial street level activity. It's going to be a decision that has to be made.
Because I know the Skyway commercial business is pretty strong too at times and places,
right,
and so on, and everyone feels that there's a need to be connected,
right,
to it. So there's some value to it.
And it may be a case, in both the downtown master plan and the DMC work, there's this concept of sort of establishing different types of streets. We refer to it as a typology, so that you have pedestrian streets and you have transit streets, and versus more auto-oriented street. It may be that you actually sort of think about skyways and the skyway versus street level in terms of on your pedestrian-oriented streets. Maybe you want more of a street level orientation. On the other streets, more of a skyway level orientation
is
okay.
Yeah.
right? Because it's those pedestrian-oriented streets tend to be your commercially business-oriented streets.
So
that's the way you approach it.
Support a mix of it then, depending on...
Well, I think it's going to be a mix, yeah.
Yeah,
okay. It's just a question of defining where it happens.
Thank you.
So, Mitzi, as we wrap up for today, what's the immediate next step?
We have a workshop with the Planning Commission this week, and we have some public meetings that are set up for May, and we can send out the dates to you, and so you'll have those available if you want to attend any of those sessions. Section 1 of the plan is already posted. It's on the P2S website. That's where we will post the PowerPoint slides as well. Sections 2 and 3 will be, they're still being edited, and they'll be posted in May. So they'll be available by then.
Okay, great. Any other final questions? Moving along.
Well, let me ask with regards to the transportation piece that you covered today, is this covered in the sections 2 and 3, or is there some sort of an addendum where you're going to put this in? Or?
No, it's right in mostly section 2.
Okay.
With policy in section. Section 3 is policy.
And then, obviously to implement this, you have to, for things that are non-restricted, non-incentive, you have to update the zoning to reflect the new land uses. Do you have a ballpark thought of... in order to get some of these mixed-use transit-oriented districts, when we'd be able to see that and give a little bit more. There's going to be a huge question out there in the intervening time, because what our zoning code is going to say is build an automobile-oriented strip mall or building with a big surface parking lot in our major corridors. This plan is going to say we want transit-oriented mixed-use development. How long are we going to be in that disconnect?
We have a draft RFP in development right now to seek out the services to help us get there as quickly as we can.
Do you have in the RFP, do you state a due date or a length of time that it will require?
But not right now. There are going to be different components to what mm-hmm. we need services for. One of those will be to address this concept of the PTN and nodes and corridors and mm-hmm. transit-oriented and transit-supported development. But then we might chunk out another piece that we may not use the same contractor for, or we might have to address infill and redevelopment, so very specifically in those core neighborhood areas. But we're going to lay that out so we have some options on how to hire the consultants and how quickly we can do that process. So
you're obviously thinking about it because there's a draft RFP out there. Do you know when that'll make its way to the council for approval?
I don't know for certain. I hope the RFP will be able to be posted in May.
All right. Anything else? Thank you. Lots of information to digest, so we look forward to the next steps. Moving on this afternoon, then, we have an indoor shooting range update. Mitzi, or do you want us? We have the memorandum that you issued. Do you want to step us through this? Or?
Sure. Can we just pause for one moment here?
Let me get out of the way.
Okay, so we were discussing indoor shooting ranges a few weeks ago, and there were several issues that came up. Some of these are related very specifically to zoning and land use policy, where they are permitted, what land use category they are in, hours of operation, those kind of things. That's all zoning. There were also some other issues related to non-zoning matters that came up, and we'll walk through several of these things. First, if you look at page 1 of the memo, you'll see that an indoor shooting range is currently included in indoor recreation. Indoor recreation includes a wide range of different recreational activities. Other indoor recreation facilities that include shooting could be firing ranges or bow and arrow. And we have several of these around town that have been permitted under the indoor recreation category. The table on that first page identifies the zoning districts in which they're currently permitted. Type 1 on the far right column means that it's a staff level review and approval. If it says type 3, there's a provisions from which they become a conditional use permit. Okay, so in the R4 zoning district, in the MRD, which is really the human services campus, the campus where we're located, that may be a 1 or a 3. That address is indoor only. Outdoor ranges are only permitted in the M2 zoning district with a conditional use permit. They're very restricted in their location, and it seems to be narrowed down to M2, which we don't have a whole lot of. Other considerations that we need feedback from the City Council on is, first and foremost, we don't believe that there are any issues with the outdoor range location and process. There haven't been any questions about that, and we just need confirmation from you that we don't need to address that. Second, when it comes to the indoor ranges, those indoor ranges could be handled in different ways. A, the council, if you wish, could separate an indoor range from the other kinds of indoor recreation facilities. What we would need from you is confirmation about whether or not that's of interest. And B, or as second part of that is, do you wish to include only indoor shooting ranges with guns and firearms, or do you also wish to include arrows, bow and arrow? Another piece of this that we need feedback on is that, or another option for you is to just leave the ordinance policy as it is and the process as it is in the zoning ordinance and make no changes. So I don't know if you want to pause and have discussion on those, or just continue to walk through this and then have discussion.
Well, we can open it up for discussion. One of the things I wanted to get out of the way right away is on the last page of your memo. If I read that correctly, it says the Minnesota statute states that we can't issue an on or off sale liquor license at a shooting facility, period.
Correct. That
so,
was a concern.
Because I know that one of the concerns that the neighborhood would have, or that others would have, I should say. So we can't do it. That's off the table, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Beyond that, Mr. Ruska, do you want
to? Sure. Well, I've been able to have a lot of the concerns shared. We had the neighborhood meeting, listened to the neighbors, had the developers there. They did a nice job of presenting their ideas and their plan. I think there is maybe the best way to probably move through this, in my eyes at least, is to make this into an indoor gun range, goes into a conditional use permit process. And that way, you know, I think when we look at the first indoor gun range that I'm aware of, there was very little input and concern. Kind of went through without any issues. The second one, there's been quite a bit more input and concern, and who knows how many more are coming through the process here. I know in researching this, there's a lot of things that impact the way that this stuff is governed and covered. I know, like, a location of a business where firearms are sold, which I believe they were planning to sell firearms here, there's certain issues that are addressed by the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms area. I know that a lot of these things are in the statute. There's OSHA involved, there's the EPA involved, there's a DNR involved, there's U.S. Fish and Wildlife that has been brought up in this thing. And so I think, you know, for us to be able to address the concerns that are there, you know, Randy mentioned one of them already, I think that a conditional use permit allows us to define these uses and define what the business is going to be so that everyone's on the same page and that the governing body then makes sure that they're covered. I know when I've talked to Mitzi a little bit about some of the things with the noise concerns, we already have ways in place to address that. But, you know, different. You know, I think then the difference between a steel trap and a rubber trap are different. Is there a concern more in safety with one or the other? I'm not sure on that yet. I think we need to do a little bit more follow-up on that. But I'm certainly happy to make it a priority. I know we talked a little bit about the size of the guns that would be used in there, whether they're fully automatic, are they going to be 50 caliber or you know, lower, is kind of what's allowed in most parts. So I think air ventilation, water clarity, Just different things, the structure, you know, 12 inches of cement is kind of what I'm hearing now. Is that roof all, you know, all the building, or is that just certain parts of the building? I think that these are all things that if we clarify and moving forward, we know that we've got, you know, the bottom line here is we want to make, you know, make sure that this business is safe as possible for the neighbors and anyone that's in the area, not only here, but in any neighborhood or in any area that it would go into. And by having a defined understanding of how it's constructed and how it's operated allows us to do so. So that's kind of what I've seen in this thing, is to try to create a balance that makes us sure that we've got everything covered and that we are all clear on what's going to happen here and how it's going to operate is just the proper way to do it. So, like I say, I'd be happy to make it a priority to meet with the planning department to go over these things and bring this back as soon as we can. I've collected all the information that I've gotten from the people concerned, from people that are in the gun business and that know things, and so, you know, I think trying to put that down and making sure that we're all clear on this is the way I see the best way to move forward. I'd be happy to hear what others have to say.
Maybe a question for the council. Is it fair to say that a shooting range, whether it's indoor or outdoor, should always be a conditional use? In other words, we would always want to see those. We'd never want to see a type 1 review. Just so that we'd have a chance to...
When you say shooting range, are you talking firearms, or are you talking any shooting range?
Well, good question.
That's
one of the questions.
Right, and I don't have a problem with archery range.
Archery.
I mean, archery is only going to be so much of a threat with the ability for anything to leave the building or anything like that. Guns have different calibers and different velocities and different, different automatics and semi-automatics and so on. So I think that being clear on that is the proper way to, from what I've seen. But you know, I don't tie the archery range concern into this. I don't see it being the same.
Mr. Bilderback, Mr. Roger.
Yeah, I guess I don't have a real issue there, except for the fact that if you're using crossbows, the velocity of those can be extremely high. So I think my personal feeling is I would like to see any type, be it a archery or a firearm, come back. I think there's questions, there's concerns, and the bow world is getting to be stronger and stronger and have more power, and so we want to make sure that the construction is appropriate.
My fear is I don't want to put a workload on the city that we are not prepared or skilled to address, and that's kind of the issue with a lot of these shooting range issues, is that these are the reason why there's, you know, six different levels of government involved with this, is because they have expertise that we don't, and I don't want to set us up in a situation. So I'm not so opposed to the conditional use permit, but I am opposed to if we're going to be making determinations on what the appropriate structure or design of a facility would be in approving a conditional use permit, as opposed to just referencing what those agencies have to say, because we're not overruling them anyway.
Right.
So
and that's what I'm getting at is a lot of these concerns are already governed by other agencies other than us. But then that clarifies that so that we are doing what we can to make sure it is as safe as possible. And then from above and beyond that, we can't over-govern someone.
Well, I just think we need to be careful how we present this because, you know, a lot of issues that were brought up to me are very valid. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, we need to clearly communicate that the city of Rochester is not going to have any determination over that. We should clearly articulate what we do have determination over and what we don't. And I just don't want to set people up to ask us to do the job of the ATF or something like that.
Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be deliberate about it, but I just think we need to make sure we also provide the business with a clear path forward. We don't want to be, you know, so restrictive that we put up roadblocks unnecessarily. So I think we need to definitely address people's fears and concerns and kind of keep it all out in the open. But I just want to make sure we give them a clear path forward so we're not putting up roadblocks for business.
I think that's where Mr. Rusk is coming.
Yep.
Making it come back as a revocable permit makes sense. That way people know it's all conditional use, people know what we're talking about, they know what's coming, it's not going to catch anybody by surprise. So I think if nothing else, the transparency of that would be a good thing to do.
Well, I think the other thing is that at the meeting I was at, there seemed to be a little bit of a lack of clarity on, you know, exactly what it was and how it was going to be, and I believe that, you know, all we can do is step in and make sure that it's to the laws and into what we govern, but I also make sure that I believe that that clarity is important too, and there's no gray areas that, well, we didn't think that mattered, or we didn't think that applied, or we didn't think that's what you meant. This way, at least, it makes it clear, and I think that's important to the neighbors, and it just seems like reasoning to me, good reasoning to me. So.
Well, I like the idea that Mr. Ruska or others are prepared to meet with planning staff. I don't think doing nothing is an option. I think we agree that the language we have today is insufficient, or at least needs some clarification. So we would need to look at that.
Well, and I think one thing I've learned is there's a lot of the level of gun sales and gun usage has gone up dramatically, and so there might be more of this in the future. And we want to be able to be fair and reasonable to everybody, but we also want to make sure that our public is safe and understands how these operate. And so, you know, I think that clarity will go a long way in that direction.
I'm glad that we do disconnect the firearms and alcohol uses. I grew up on the Iron Range, and I moved away from there for a reason.
I won't go there. Anyone else? Ms. Baker.
I just want to make sure that we have clear guidance from you. There was discussion about whether or not to include bow and arrow, or just to limit this to firearms as being separated out from indoor recreation. I will point out, I don't believe we've ever received a noise complaint from a bow and arrow range. I don't believe that we have any record of any accidents or disasters happening, either from bow and arrow or from a gun range. So my preference is that you narrow this down as much as possible. And if bow and arrow is not a high priority for you to add as a conditional use, leave it in as indoor recreation.
So you made a comment, Mitzi, that outdoor is already pretty well underhand in terms of its very restricted M2 zones and so forth. So are we in agreement that we don't need to spend more time on that? Is it primarily the indoor uses that we need to narrow down? We can strike that one off your list.
And I guess I would, again, my concern is, I agree with Mitzi on the bow and arrow. I don't think that's an issue, so I don't really believe that's a priority. I haven't heard too much of crossbow or any of that. I don't know too much about that. I don't own guns or shoot bow and arrow, so I don't know any of it. But I do believe that the concern that I have right now is over the caliber of the guns and the different types of guns that are being used and making sure that our neighborhoods are safe from any developments that would contain these.
Okay. Other questions, comments?
Now, I'm willing to go along with that. I just think that it may be something we end up coming back to in
right.
the future. But to work on this, to try to get this figured out, I'm willing to go with fire.
Yeah, and I agree. We might have to revisit that in the future, because if we're having crossbow or compound bow, some of those can be just as dangerous as a firearm in an outside environment, so we might have to revisit that at a later time.
I will say, a bow and arrow outdoor range would still be covered, though, under outdoor recreation.
Okay.
All right. This is only for indoor.
All right. And we're good. So do we have our next step forward? Are we...
One more.
Go ahead.
So at the very bottom of page four of your packet, the end of this memo, there's also a recommendation that the city initiate a change to the Code of Ordinance 8513. So we can modify the language there to really focus in on areas where the discharge of firearms is allowed, and if there is a permitted facility, that ought to be listed. I don't know if we need to do an RCA for that. Be a formal action.
Yes.
Ask the city attorney.
Yes, if you're changing the ordinance, it would require an RCA. And you could say a permitted shooting range.
Right. Any questions or comments on that change, Mr. Hickey?
I just, police chief wants to get out of the shooting range business. All right, sounds fair.
All right, Mr. Rusty.
And for those that maybe are listening, or this will be brought back for public input once we get the conditional use permit drawn up. So There will be a chance for input, and in the meantime, I'm happy to take any information, any input that folks want to have on both sides. I think the whole idea in this is to work together and to come up with something that is safe and reasonable and allows people to do business as they believe is right. So there will be, with public hearing, the opportunity for people to weigh in at that time. So it isn't like once we draw it up, that's the final version.
Well, this will be a text amendment, so it'll go through the Planning and Zoning Commission as well as the City Council.
Right. Ms. Johnson?
I'm just curious, when we start looking at this change of the ordinance, this has nothing to do with archery then? Because I saw that archery was crossed off. I'm asking because there's an archery range in a park.
The bottom of page 4.
The bottom of page 4, yes. Is that just guns, or is that taking archery? Because there are outdoor archery ranges in town.
We could leave that as indoor shooting or archery, if that's a concern, mm-hmm. to be more inclusive.
I think it should be, but...
Yeah, the definition of shooting range technically includes both.
Okay, that was...
Archery and firearms.
Okay. I was not aware of that.
So when we define a new use category, we may actually have to call it a firearms shooting range, so it's very clear that it's not any kind of shooting range.
All right. And again, I think for the benefit of some of the folks that have contacted us, it bears repeating that alcohol use is not going to be permitted, period, no matter what we do here.
I do want the City Council to be aware that we have received an application, a type 1 application for a site development plan for an indoor shooting range. And we will need to seek some feedback from the City Attorney on how to handle that, because the application's already been filed.
In what zone?
The M1?
B4.
So on the May 1st council meeting, you can initiate what you, by consensus, have agreed to, and that'll take care of the application.
Okay.
So the initiation of an amendment to the zoning ordinance acts as a de facto moratorium, essentially. It does not allow that application to be approved.
All right. Okay. Anyone else? Any other questions, Mitzi, or clarifications you need from us in the meantime? All right.
Different topic. Clarification for Vincey. We were scheduled also to discuss the comp plan at the retreat, the first part of the retreat. Have you heard enough about the comp plan? And I don't. You don't have any other information to offer on this?
I don't have any more to present. So it would be just discussion. You may need that time for other things, but we did cover the material we intended to.
Okay. Mr. Woodard?
Well, my only talk would be is, you know, the only thing I could see added to this is some back and forth on how we handle the process of implementation when the when this effectively takes effect. I think the gun. Well, I think I know your position on the gun range.
No, I was
so.
Just trying to figure out after what she said. I'm trying to figure out where you're
talking
about the gun plan.
Yeah, I mean that's the key thing is that you know. As a city attorney, to say once we initiate the change to an ordinance,
zoning ordinance, yes,
then it's a de facto moratorium. Is that how we handle the comp plan as well?
So we're not going to build anything until we.
We're not going to build anything that conflicts with the comp plan.
I don't think we're ready for that discussion. I think when we have the plan, all the materials, and all the drafts available. Before we set public hearing dates, we can have a discussion around that and gather some more information beforehand. But I don't think we're prepared for that.
Okay.
Do an RCA for May 1st for that initiation.
Yes.
All right. Okay, so I assume then, unless I hear otherwise, that we'll just start the retreat and we will get into the campaign.
What are you going to build it in?
I do think Mitzi is trying to move it up as fast as she can forward the RFP. So.
Mitzi gets a pass, I believe, is what.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll be there for other matters.
Perfect.
Okay. Moving on, we have the RDA annual report and funding request. Ms. Bolton.
Thank you.
Okay, are we ready? All right, let's turn the floor over to Jenna Bowman. Go ahead.
Council President Saver, Mayor, thank you for having us here today. I know that we are at about 45 minutes of information, and I'll honor the time of getting us through in about 20. But with that said, I plan to, and I obviously still allow for questions at the end, but in the lieu of time, feel free as we move through the presentation to ask any questions as we move through. I did want to clarify, this is just our annual update to the council. There is no additional funding request aside from what comes at the end of the year.
So,
I support that.
we're very concerned with having to report that. So just quickly grounding us again, I believe you may have seen some of this information last year, but as a part of our brand update, we went through more deeper levels than just an update to our logo. So I'll let you read on the screen here, but as far as our purpose, our vision, our values, these have been really driving pieces for us in the last year, especially as far as what we're focusing on and what value we're bringing to the community. I have members of my team here, I think mainly all sitting together, which is great. But Ender Gochman, who's standing here, is our marketing manager. Ender has been with us since July of 2014. Cassandra is a new member of our team as of just the beginning part of March. She is our community engagement manager. Carly McElroy, who's also here. Carly has been with us since July of 2014. And then Abby is our event specialist. Abby is a new member of our team as well. She is with us 30 hours a week as a contract staff. So as we talked about when we made our funding request to the city last year, which included an increase to our funding, it was to expand our capacity. I can tell you, having that additional capacity has been wonderful, especially as it relates to one of our strategic priorities, which I'll get into just a little bit, which is our stakeholder relations. Our board of directors, I won't go through all of these, I'll let you read them, but we have a very strong board. Vern O'Brien from 318 Commons is here with us today, and with the staff. Vern is our board chair. Al Menino is also with us here today. He is our vice chair. As you can see, too, we have a very broad range of board members, and I mean that both in areas of business they represent, as well as their experience in downtown, age, etc. I did want to personally thank Councilmember Ruska. Councilmember Ruska is in his seventh year with the RDA, which is the most amount of time that you can serve with us, and he'll be completing his seventh year come December. So just thank you for all of your time with the RDA and all that you've given to our organization. So in terms of our budget, our 2017 budget, you'll see on the screen here is our expenses and revenues. We do try to net zero. I'm happy to report, we've always seen been in good financial standings where we've never had to report a loss. Even with, events as large as ours, we take very seriously the calendar of our year and ensuring that we're meeting those marks that we need to. As we just talk about expenses here, you'll see the breakout in terms of percentages, but as far as our general marketing, events and programs, Thursdays on first and third, our operations and administration. And then as far as our revenues, just to reground us there too, the city and Mayo Clinic have been providing $75,000 since we started in 2005. Both the city and Mayo did increase their contributions by $25,000 apiece as of last year. So those both reflecting 12% of our budget. Our special service district accounts for 31% of our budget, and the RDA does generate 45% of our budget. If you take us back to when we started as an organization, the special service district accounted for 50% of our budget, and the City of Rochester Mayo Clinic accounted for 25, so 50% there. So you can see that we do take it very seriously, that we're looking for ways to obviously diversify our budget. Just a couple of notes as far as our budget goes. Even in seeing our growth and RDA-generated funds. In 2014, the RDA generated 36% of its budget, so you'll see almost a 10% growth just in the last few years. And then over the last 3 years, we've also expanded our sponsorship. This is not just one calendar year, but just as far as what we've expanded in our sponsorship, over $40,000. And that continues to expand. So as you look at the increases, especially in the ways that we're able to generate our revenues, it's a focus on sponsorship growth. So as far as our strategic priorities for this year, these were set by our board of directors in the fall of 2016. Stakeholder relations, marketing and promotion of that downtown, programming, collaborations, what we call as being the downtown experts. As most all of you are familiar, we maintain pretty much the same 44 block area within the downtown. Approximately 320 businesses are within our special service district boundary. As you know, we're seeing increased density into the downtown. So as we see new developments, larger developments, we are seeing those numbers increase, and I anticipate we'll see those increase quite dramatically in the coming years. So how are we reaching our stakeholders? Stakeholder relations really came out of a survey that we completed last August, October, where 88 of our stakeholders completed the survey, and only 30% had responded that they agreed that they either knew and felt connected to the RDA Board of Directors. Obviously, we all know as organizations, we have opportunities to improve. We took this very seriously as an organization, and thus you'll see a couple of slides that is speaking to how we are reaching our stakeholders and really making an intentional effort to close that, where we hope to see 50% plus that are saying that they feel connected and really know our Board of Directors. So those include items like our quarterly print newsletter. This was started in October of 2014. It's focused on our stakeholders, so different than when we interact with the general public. We mail 325 of those out quarterly. We feature a stakeholder, so it's kind of telling that unique story of largely a lot of our locally owned small businesses. We are in the process of also featuring board members, which is meant to help improve that connectivity back to our stakeholders, really knowing and feeling like they are connected to those boards, board members, and also providing recaps and previews of what's happening. We also, in 2016, started what we refer to as the DMC quarterly update sessions. This came directly back from a conversation that I had with a downtown stakeholder who said, you know, I'm getting a lot of questions from my clients as it relates to DMC. Wouldn't it be great if we could even be better advocates for what's happening in the downtown? So that kicked off this conversation with DMC, and now in this year, we're doing four sessions. We had our first session just about a month ago, and it's really that opportunity for downtown stakeholders to receive updates directly about DMC from the DMC staff. Topics have ranged anything from what developments are coming online to questions about transportation and about you know, things like the heart of the city process, etc. So we take, again, it's that very personalized approach to our stakeholders' opportunities to connect with organizations. This is also something that's new for us in 2017. We are doing quarterly industry-specific stakeholder sessions. The intentionality is that we're doing extra outreach to connect with those businesses across industries. You'll see up on the screen here, this is the invite for the retail stakeholder session that will be occurring May 23rd. We'll be, again, holding four of these. And really the goal is to increase two-way discussion, engagement, and also provide educational components, which also includes how do you give us feedback on what you're seeing, whether it's a participating in event, et cetera, when you're trying to connect and interact with over 320 businesses with a full-time staff before. You can imagine that's a bit of a challenge, but one that we always try to seek really creative ways and impactful ways to engage with our stakeholders. And then our annual report and annual meeting. We had our first annual meeting back in 2016. There were over 100 people in attendance. You can see a photo of that here. We also started creating annual reports in 2015, which has been a great way to both recap the previous year and provide a preview of next year. And it just continues to deepen transparency and opportunity for engagement. So as you recall, in one of our strategic priorities was the general marketing downtown. The next few slides we'll talk about ways in which we are doing that. The first is last year we did an industry-specific targeted campaign. It was focused on, it was the Eat and Drink campaign, and it was really a test. So we took, we used this as a test to look at the feasibility of creating and executing based on our available resources, so that might be budget, staff, etc. And that was really meant to perpetuate the downtown brand. Again, as we launched a brand refresh in March, we wanted to, the great thing about that brand is it's very basic in concept, but as you can see here with the visuals, it really highlights people, place, and experience in something like food and drink. It was also a connectivity between physical assets and the digital space. So specifically as we talk about something like our website, we did see great increases to web traffic, specifically in the restaurant area of the website. And it was also meant to raise awareness to the range of unique services offered in the downtown brand. So as we talk about 2017, we are going to be focusing on shop, so our retail area. Right now that campaign is planned for quarter three. And again, looking to do a lot of those same things that we did with the Eat and Drink campaign. But also what you're probably noticing, and it's in a couple slides here, is that it's the use of a media suite, which is through our photos to show the distinctive downtown brand. So the images that you were seeing on this previous slide and on this one, these were photos specifically taken of our downtown businesses. Social media continues to see great growth. There's been a lot of intentionality as far as our focus in this area and building up our audiences and really ensuring that there's dialogue with whether event attendees or those looking to explore and engage in our downtown. So the media suite, this is one that we're really excited about, not only because it's allowing us to intentionally fill a gap as it relates to representing people, place, and experience, but it's also, we also have the unique and great ability to be working with a downtown stakeholder. Sean Fagan with Red Couch Stories, or Sean with Fagan Studios has Red Couch Stories, and that's who we're working with on this media suite. And that essentially means through this media suite, which was a whole year, is that we're capturing images and video that then we can then repurpose and use. So when you're seeing, whether it's pieces that we're putting out or say something that's showing up on TV, those aren't stock images, they're actual images of the downtown. As you can imagine, there's a definite art and skill to taking general photos but still capturing the essence of downtown. I'm sure if you have been into one of these establishments, you probably know who they are, yet we're not calling out exactly who they are. And that's with definite intention because we realize we don't have an endless budget. This is actually being done on a very modest budget, but we can't hit all of the 320 businesses. So we're doing our best to try to capture a broad range of business and industry while also keeping it general so no one business feels like they're being left out or highlighted. The media suite will have been completed once we get to the summertime here. And again, you're starting to see, but you'll continue to see these images and the video being shown and leveraged. So our 2017 programs, I wanted to talk about this specifically because it really captures what the RDA has been trying to do as far as partnership and collaboration. The first one, and again, going back to our strategic priorities, they connect with programming, collaborations, and then stakeholder relations. So the first one is the Bookworm Walk, and these programs are being facilitated by Carly in our office. So the Bookworm Walk, as you'll see here, it's a partnership with the Rochester Public Library, and also we're very appreciative to Park and Rec for being open to sometimes our crazy ideas. But really the intentionality of this is to target kids and families. We know that's a big demographic that we oftentimes hear. You know, it's hard to come down and find something to do, especially if it's non-event related. So through this program, throughout the course of the summer, there will be two different books that will be essentially along a walking path. This kind of gives you a better idea of exactly what that geography is. But there's 17 stops along the route, and at each one of these stops, two pages of those books will be shared. So you can start at the library and make your way down to that beautiful water feature down by the river, and you will have completed, you know, essentially read a book if you will. So again, it's really focusing on passive programming and partnerships. It's, as you saw in the previous slide, it's a part of the library summer playlist series. We've long time had a focus on activating kind of the riverfront, if you will. But I think the neat thing and what we're really excited about with this and others that you'll see is it's leveraging the great partnerships and opportunities that exist with organizations where it's not just an RDA project, but really a collaboration amongst other entities. Another program that we are working on is called Let's Play Rochester. The target audience for this is really all ages, and we are working with the Minnesota Children's Museum Rochester. This one is better explained through photos. So what you can expect to see in the downtown this summer is anywhere from 3 to 5 sidewalk installations. It might be a creative, some dots that are encouraging you to maybe do something unique or gets you thinking about something different, or it might be something like avoiding alligators. But again, this is showing the opportunity for passive programming and for the opportunity for all ages to engage in our downtown. And as we know with our friends at the Children's Museum, they're really great about encouraging play, and we can bring that into our downtown in a very intentional way. Move on the Plaza. So we've been very fortunate that Zumba has been taking place in the Plaza for the last few years. We thought what better way to help promote Rochester as American City for Health than to offer even more complementary programming as it relates to health and fitness. So in this space, if you take Zumba out of it, because it's been happening, except that it's a part of this, they are included in this programming, we will be adding 12 additional dates of programming. Again, these are free classes, whether it be dance, bar, pound, or yoga, that's happening throughout the course of the summer. So we're more than just about doubling the free health-focused programming that will be happening on the Plaza this summer. And then as a part of our partnership with these three entities, Carly has worked very hard along with Ender to create all of the promotional items here. We estimate what we're providing just in value with something like the creation of this. This branding is over $2,000 that we are providing through our partnership. And then, obviously, we know programming is incredibly important in the downtown, and the RDA can't be the only ones to do it, nor should we. I think we'd all get kind of bored with that. But I wanted to touch on this because Rochester Jazz Fest was an event that received a startup grant from us last year. It was a $3,000 grant for a unique first-time event. Jazz Fest had a great response by the community. John, who created this event, knows a ton about jazz, but what we saw an opportunity was is to really work closely with him to hopefully have this event sustain and continue year after year. So we are continuing our financial support of this event by $3,000 this year, but I can tell you Carly's working with him directly to ensure that we can help provide our best areas of expertise as it relates to things like sponsorship generation, marketing, how do you secure volunteers, how are you running successful events, in the hopes, again, that we're supporting events to become sustainable and really iconic for the city of Rochester as we move forward. So you'll see what we're providing. The $3,000 this year, it's also with the understanding that we're scaling back our funding next year with the hopes, again, that he's sustainable with his program. And then this is a unique one. It's Moms Who Lunch. So the Rochester Moms blog is one that continues to grow its impact in Rochester, and they had approached us to say, hey, we'd love to do a downtown lunch series for moms throughout the course of the summer. So we were able to let the downtown restaurants know about this opportunity. They came back pretty much right away, and there was four that stepped forward that said they wanted to be a part of it. And I think this shows, while the RDA doesn't need to be the convener of the events, we can have a direct impact on our stakeholders by working with other entities and then bringing those opportunities to them. They definitely sold out really quickly for the first lunch, and I would imagine they would continue to do so. But again, these are the creative ways in which we're looking to partner and expand opportunity for the downtown stakeholders. And then our 2017 core event portfolio, a couple of things I wanted to note here is that in the last 3 years, 4 out of the 10 events that you're seeing here have been added. They're brand new. A couple of things worth noting is Dogs Downtown last year We were in our still very early on with this event. We had over 9,000 people who were estimated to be in attendance, and that was a Sunday afternoon in August. Fall Fest, which was a family and kid focused event, had 9,000 attendees in its inaugural year. And Ladies Night Out, we saw a great showing again this year. So again, 4 out of the 10 that you're seeing up here on the screen have been new, and just thinking about what that has meant in terms of event attendees, that's been a growth of close to 20,000 event attendees as far as adding to some very strong events already. So one of the things that our board has been focused on is knowing that not all of our events are set up to actually break even or make any revenue. But what we've focused on in the last little over a year is the impact on the investment. And I think this piece of data is just one of many pieces of data that we have. But over 75% of those who have attended an RDA event have stated that they feel more connected to the Rochester community after attending that RDA event. You know, I can tell you some events that we have seen that percentage has been close to 97%, which is just pretty incredible when you think about the impact of the investment and what it means for our community. Another piece that we've been focusing on is the economic impact. So you'll see through 5 events here, one of the questions we ask is, how much did you spend when you were downtown for this event? You'll see Thursdays on 1st and 3rd, by and large, was a huge impact with over $6 million estimated in economic impact. Socialize coming in 2nd at over 1.3. So we estimate just through these 5 events alone, because it's hard, that's what we can track, over $8 million estimated for economic impact for 2016. We're continuing to track that, and we're excited to be able to have a second year of data to be able to compare that against. And then just some unique comments. These have come directly from our event surveys. A couple that I'll note here, you know, specifically with a certified tourism community host stating that this was really helpful and that they should hopefully be able to use this when talking to visitors. But one that I wanted to share from a merchant: we have built such a strong rapport with our clientele as well as with new customers. Not only does it create such a positive and fun atmosphere for both local and visitors, but it also unites downtown businesses together. And that, I think, speaks to exactly why we create and why we like to see Ladies Night Out being so successful, because it really highlights some of our greatest assets, which are our downtown businesses. So again, that was very quick through that. Again, trying to be mindful of time. And knowing there was a lot of content to cover today, I did want to provide packets of information. Included in here is our full presentation that was shared today, as well as this was a print version of the Eat and Drink campaign that was done, 2 of our most recent 2017 event recaps, and then you also have our most recent print newsletter, as well as our 2016 annual report. So no shortage of information, that's for sure. But as I continue to say too, as we interact with the council, and as I continue to encourage our board, if there's information that you want that's not there, or if there's things that you're not hearing that from us that you'd like to, I'm very much committed to that you're getting that information, and definitely in a timely manner.
All right, Mr. Woodger.
We thought about a shooting range downtown.
Archery.
I'll stay out of that debate.
Yeah, what I wanted to ask, though, what I'm really interested in seeing is, and I assume the RDA would be a good body to perhaps have this data already. I'm really interested in seeing the total number of retail square feet in the district, and the total number of retail square feet that's local businesses, not national change. I think there's a lot of interest in the community and making sure we maintain a local business presence downtown, not just all national chains. And any information that you could provide and track over time with that, I think, would be very interesting to the community.
And I would say, you know, as we talk about being a downtown expert and we look at a gap like data, that would be one that I would, you know, love to talk to our colleagues about DMC on, because mm-hmm. as we know too, with data comes dollar signs and the ability to do that. I would say with our current capacity and budget, we probably couldn't fill that completely. I do agree it's a very important component. most recently I was working with one of our, well, our two retail board members, and one of the questions I asked as we prepare for this retail stakeholder session, I said, what's your sense as far as concerns about losing your space or your footing in the downtown? And his comment back to me was, you know, I really haven't been hearing a lot of that from my fellow merchants, which is really positive to hear. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that that comment is representative of all feelings, but hopefully what we're also seeing is some support and some demand that's helping support our locally owned small businesses. As a part of the other data I didn't share here, but I'm happy to share it, is that when we did do that stakeholder survey last year, we asked in 2014, is business up, down, or about the same? We saw a very strong percentage that were saying it's up. So.
Would it be possible, just to follow up on the topic, is this something that you could bring up with DMC then in terms of how we track this? Because that's one of the pushbacks you always get, but you know, driving the local vendors out, and if the data doesn't suggest that, would you be okay with following up with DMC?
Absolutely, and that's a focus of ours going into this year, and we've started to have those conversations. We want to be very, very, very mindful, and the board knows it well. As I've also said, these are going to be commitments that we are making over time and that we're building, so we're not, overcommitting but under-delivering. So I would anticipate, Michael, that those types of conversations will occur this next year, and then we look at how, you know, we could fill those gaps. And I think from a council perspective, those are great things to be hearing back from the council. What areas or data is there a gap in right now that you'd like for us to look into and either lead or look to partner on?
Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much. A lot's going on, and year-round, that's the important thing. It started with a lot of things in the summertime months, but it's great to see year-round activities. So thank you very much for that.
Absolutely. And I would echo that. One of the comments that came up during Heart of the City conversations is, you know, why is it so dead in the winter? I said, well, because we're really busy throughout the summer. But I think that just you're seeing, even too, with new events and the strong engagement by the communities, that with more dollars and more resources and more support, we'll just continue to have a focus on and be able to fill that, you know, any sort of gap in terms of our 12 month calendar year.
All right, thank you. Did you have something on
this? Just, John, thanks for the work you're doing. I just throw out to the council, since this is my last year on the board, this is an enjoyable board. There's a lot more, seems like a lot more activity in this board than a lot of them we serve on. I think anytime you've got 320 businesses that all have a little skin in the game, and there's new programming and everything that goes on, there's always items that come up, and yet it's fun to be part of a group that's cutting the ground and doing new things and making new excitement in our city. So, as we get into next year, and when the next board members wants to roll, or council members wants to roll on the board, it is a board that you'll be engaged, and there's a lot going on, so keep that in mind, and I'll miss it. It's been fun 7 years. I've seen a lot of change, and so, Jenna, keep up the good work.
All right, thank you. With that, I know we're running a little tight on time, but we have a couple of quick other business items to take care of. Hopefully they're very quick. Mr. Ruska, do you want to start?
Yeah, I wanted to just throw out that with all of our stuff here that's been going on, I'd like to see if we can get an update from the Senior Center here soon. I'd like to maybe get an update on their financials compared to the projections that we saw last year. Membership actuals, fundraising actuals, usage versus projections, relationship with the Park and Rec Department, other information. I just think it's time that we kind of, now that they're up and operating, that we start to plan on getting a report from them on some of those numbers and some of those things.
At my request, they're putting together a packet for the council, and they will be meeting with administration tomorrow.
Okay, then will we get something to us?
I assume so. I'll leave it to administration to figure out exactly how that happens.
And then I might ask, Paul, you've been, maybe you can have some input on that too, because I think you're out there working with them in the same building, and some of the maybe good things or challenges or whatever, that'd be good to hear about those too.
Yeah, I think you might be of interest how we're scheduling in rooms.
Some pool, everything like that.
Yeah, there's been some good trends as far as maximizing capacity, some probably under utilized in some areas on both sides of that, and being happy to share that.
Okay, good.
All right, that's all I got to do. Okay, I want to take a couple minutes just to talk a little bit about the Art Center. I think most, if not all of us, have now had some opportunity to meet with the executive board or the staff members and talk a little bit about what they're doing after the that recent report came out, and I know that and it's very positive in the sense that they are bringing in some expert individuals to help evaluate their finance, and they're working out a kind of a strategic plan, primarily along the lines of financing. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they intend to present that plan, that strategy, at their annual meeting on May 24th, I believe. Any of us have probably also been approached by many and around the community ideas on what we could or should do, and I've been kind of taking that in stride, as I'm sure everyone else is. Most often what we hear about are co-joined uses of that building, things of that nature. And I think for us as a council, what we look at is the highest and best use of an asset, in this case, the Art Center building. And of course, we're trying to find the best use for community uses and things like that. So here's my question for the council is, given that we're expecting some finance information in middle to late May, but what's your sense of urgency as you've maybe listened to what the art staff have offered? What's your sense of urgency? Should we be giving some others around the community a bit more sense of where we think we might head with that building?
When you say others, who are the others?
I've heard from other arts groups. I've heard from the Children's Museum in terms of some other ideas that they want to do. A variety of ideas that I didn't want to commit to. Certainly, we don't want to commit to anything at this point. But let me tell you this, where I'm coming from, as I listen to what I'm hearing from the Art Center, I'm not comfortable yet. I mean, I hear what they're doing in terms of some of their financing strategies, and I really, really hope that they're successful, but my comfort level is not there yet. So what I'm wondering is, are we willing to wait that another month and a half, or do we want to, are we saying we would at least entertain or open the door for other ideas? Don't know what those are. I just wanted to kind of, I'm trying to get a feel for what others are thinking. Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, so I mean, right now, I mean, I would be willing to let them give them a chance to get their legs underneath them. Mm-hmm. Unless they're coming for an ask of money out of cycle, which I'm not hearing. I mean, I don't see a sense of urgency unless you know something I don't know. It sounds like they've got a restructuring plan. I don't know all the details, but I'd definitely give them some runway and see what happens.
And that's fine. I just wanted to get a sense of where everybody else was at. Mr. Buildback and then Mr. Roll.
I agree. I think we let them have their restructuring. Let's see how it goes in a month or so. When they come back to us, they'll be able to tell us. I don't think it would be helpful to them for us to start entertaining and making commitments from other groups on what should be in that building until we get an opportunity to see where they're at. So I'd say give them a month or so to figure it out.
And I would say purely from a financial standpoint, The numbers that came out in those reports are not too dissimilar from what we had presented to the City Council in their updates. I mean, that's why they've been coming to us for these updates. I would be more concerned now that we're in the just about complete Mayo Civic Center phase, if the trend would continue the way it is. But my belief is that their rentals, and I think they have some data that shows this already for 2018, are reverting back to the pre-construction levels. So I don't, it was a big brouhaha in the media, but some of these issues have been known for many, many months before that. So I'm increasingly comfortable, but I do think that there were some things from a city standpoint in terms of maintenance of the asset that perhaps when that building was built, we didn't necessarily take care of properly. We might have to revisit some of the construction aspects of that building in terms of how it operates.
And then, of course, Ms. Johnson, you're our representative on the board.
Yeah, how you like that?
No pressure, so hopefully we will have someone there with eyes and ears and keep us informed of what's going on. And if you have any concerns, questions, please let us know.
Just if you use that building for some other purposes, there will be some pushback from those people that raise money for the Art Center. I had a conversation with a man the other day that said he raised $3 million for it. and it was used for some other purpose, he'd want that money paid back. Mm-hmm. But obviously you can't pay that money back, but they did raise quite a bit of money for just that purpose, and if it's not used as an art center, there'll be those people that raise that money will be upset.
Right, and I don't want anyone to misunderstand. I wasn't proposing, well, let's kick the art center out, and what else do we want to do? Absolutely not. But by the same token, I didn't know if we were saying that we would only consider the art center, or would we be willing to entertain at some point other uses, co-joined uses, or things of that matter. But I'm hearing that people are willing to give the art center the runway through the May time frame to come back with their strategy and see where it goes.
6 weeks really isn't very long, so yeah, in the grand scheme of things.
What I would like to suggest too, in the bigger picture, and I wrote a piece for the Med City Beat about how we handle these non-city agencies in the future. I do think that's imperative on our behalf that we more clearly articulate with a contract what the expectations are both ways between these institutions, and make sure that we have some professional staff overseeing those expectations. We really aren't doing that to a very high level right now, so my intention will be based on that, right, at least bring forward some sort of a resolution for action to kick off this basically analysis by city staff. We're talking about millions of dollars annually when we're talking about these non-city entities. We don't have a good contract in place today.
All right. So those are things I had. Anything else for the good of the cause?
I just thought, just a small thing. I'm blanking on what it was, but we had asked staff to come back with something for us in the second quarter. At the previous meeting, I couldn't remember what it is, and it didn't show up on the list of things we have coming up for our committee of the whole meetings. So, anyone help?
Do you have any recollections?
There's a lot of stuff on
there.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember the subject. It was on. I'm not sure.
We'll check our
review it.
Okay. All right.
All right. All right. Anything else? We are adjourned. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.